Welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged Podcast, a podcast that is committed to bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet directly to your earbuds. And, you know, I've had a whole list of these incredible women on podcasts over the last several months, and today will be no exception. Today on the podcast, I have an incredible woman named Peachy Keenan. Actually, that's a pseudonym. But she is a writer, she's a mother, and probably her greatest asset is the fact that she's a mother. She lives deep behind enemy lines, and she identifies as a, catch this, a husbosexual. I'm going to let her explain that to you. She gave up a career writing for corporate behemoths so that she could devote herself to her family, and she calls herself, the title of the book, she calls herself a domestic extremist. And this book is a practical guide to winning the culture war. And we've talked about this culture war, the woke war in Western civilization, in which you have a false dichotomy between the oppressed and the oppressor, in which kids are the primary target, in which extremism is the new watchword of the day. In fact, we did an entire journal, Christian Research Journal, The War on Western Civilization, everything you need to know about the cult of wokeism, that also available for anyone who stands shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. But we're talking about a book that I think is extremely important. Peachy has the ability to use humor in a powerful way. And I thought about this a lot because when you think about the LGBTQ, you know, the alphabet soup, plus revolution, it started with humor. You started to laugh. You saw sitcoms that caused you to laugh. So she now has turned the table and is using humor in a very effective way to debunk and to destroy a worldview that is literally destroying Western civilization. So I am just delighted to have Peachy Keenan on the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hi, Peachy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. I love to see your smiling face.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, so I was going to ask you, how do you have the temerity to use humor for such a serious subject?
Yeah, how dare I try to make people laugh? You know, I mean, I came out of, you know, that world of I'm a former liberal, I'm a former feminist, and, you know, I was very deep into pop culture and entertainment. I love all that stuff. And I couldn't help but notice that that is a very effective way to communicate with an audience. You know, one of my old heroes, my childhood heroes, Johnny Carson, he would kind of bring the country together under like really a consensus based on what he would make a joke about. And then he would make it okay for other people to have that opinion about some politician and everyone could laugh at it. And then we'd move on. And it was like unity through humor. And so it is an effective weapon. There's another reason I use humor. Well, first of all, that's just who I am. That's my personality. Okay. For better or worse. But the left is very good and very smart at using mockery because they recognize, this goes back to Saul Alinsky, you know, his rules for radicals, that mockery is really very hard to defend when it's directed towards you and personal biting attacks. I mean, I don't like to be mean, you know, obviously, but to mock certain ideologies, certain beliefs, mock ridiculous things that are harmful to us, we should be using mockery. We should call it out as what it is, as ridiculous. And I also believe that the side that is having the most fun in the end will win. If we can make it fun to be one of us, we're not school marms. We're not going to, you know, wrap you on the knuckles with a ruler if you make a mistake. We can just make it more fun. And I think that young people on the right are having a lot of fun sharing memes. And so, yeah, I mean, my message is serious. I wanted it to go down with a spoonful of sugar.
So you're not one of the characters in The Handmaid's Tale.
Exactly. Nope.
So, you know, I'm going to ask you the most obvious question. What is a domestic extremist?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I like to joke that I'm not a domestic extremist. I'm just extremely domestic. But this idea really came out of once I kind of had too many children, for my neighbors, they would notice I was having another baby. Uh-oh, you know, or that I was going to mass with my children, or that I was, you know, we were not going to public school. We were kind of already kind of withdrawing ourselves from mainstream American culture. And people started to look at me and treat me like I was some sort of actual extremist. Like I was some fringe radical, you know, for having literally three children. I have more than three now, for converting to Catholicism, for deciding to quit my corporate job at the giant woke corporation so that I could nurse my baby. That was considered radical and really weird. And women especially, you know, would judge me, would criticize me, would say, why are you doing that? Like, how could you be doing that? So I did start to feel like I was some kind of extremist. And then we can see around us, the FBI and the DOJ are calling parent groups who protest, you know, the woke curriculum, the sex ed or whatever, they're being called literal domestic terrorists. So I think that it's apt that we are, just by being domestic people, by being moms and dads, we are actually literally being considered domestic extremists, but we're just extremely domestic. It's okay. Don't be afraid of us.
You know, your subtitle is intriguing as well. I love the title of the book. It draws you in immediately. But the subtitle, A Practical Guide to Winning the Culture War. The first thing that comes to my mind is, do you think we're too far along to win the culture war? If you read your book, you're saying absolutely not. We can win this culture war.
Yeah, people ask me that a lot. When you put it in the subtitle of your book, people expect you to have an answer. And I mean, I do think it's important to stay positive. I mean, if I thought it was over and that we lost and the left won, I mean, what would be the point, you know, of anything? What would be the point of having another baby, getting up in the morning, trying to homeschool your children? We would just all kind of quit and give up. It was over. So we have to, you know, be happy warriors, and we have to hope that, yes, we can make a difference. I do believe that there's enormous strength in our numbers. You know, we're not going to go quietly into that good night. They can't put us all in the gulag, even if they try, or the digital gulag, or silence all of us. So my book is really about, well, how do we increase our numbers? How do we make sure that young couples can have the family size they want, maybe an extra child or two? And then, most importantly, make sure that their children are not caught in the kind of woke spider web, and they don't get kind of sucked away to the dark side. Make sure that your own children will one day hope to have their own families and protect them from all of these kind of nefarious influences. So by doing that incrementally, yes, we absolutely can win. I mean, there was a New York Times article 2 days ago about humanity is going to peak in 50 years and there'll be a rapid decline in our population, which is not good. But even the article, buried deep in the article, it said, if only like one out of every five couples has one extra kid in this country, that disaster can be averted. So there is like a sea change we can make now that in a generation will, in fact, help us, enable us to win. But it requires people to actually get the message.
You know, there are prominent pastors. I think of Oliver Buzz Thomas, a prominent Baptist pastor who is criticizing people like me for having 12 children.
How dare you?
How dare you? And yeah, you're saying exactly the opposite. I should be one of your heroes, of course. My wife should, at least.
Wow, 12 kids is beautiful. I love it.
Well, we have 9 natural and 3 adopted.
Wow, incredible. What a blessing.
Yeah. And you're saying that's the way to go.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, it is, parenthood is a calling. And I'm not saying, and I would never say, that every single person, every single adult must have X number of children. No, that's not what I'm saying at all. There's always going to be people who choose childlessness. There's people who are, unfortunately, you know, they're tragically are infertile. They can't have the children they want. There's always going to be people who don't ever meet a partner and they're not able to have children. I get all of that totally. My point is that the people who do manage to find a decent partner, who decide to take the leap into marriage, and who do it when they're still young enough to have more than two children, should be encouraged and celebrated and really enticed into expressing their fertility. Don't stop at one or two. I mean, I live here in California, in Southern California, and it really does feel like there's a law against having more than two children. You can't have more children that can fit in the back seat of the Range Rover. You know what I mean? But people should not, people feel constrained for climate change reasons, economic reasons. I get all of that. What I'm saying is if we can peel off just a few more young families and encourage them to have the child that they want, the child that they will regret not having one day. Cause trust me, I hear that all the time. You know, I wish I'd had one more. I didn't want one and my husband didn't want one. Then I think we can win. Not everybody is called like you to 12 or like me to 5. I understand that. But I think that there is a lot of opportunity for people who maybe only have one and aren't sure to have a second or have two and want a third.
Yeah, I want to talk about that a little more later on, but I always say the contrast is the conduit to clarity. And you make the contrast between two words that are alliterated, feminism and feminine. I want you to talk about that a little bit. I think that's a brilliant contrast. Feminism has been a blight to our culture. You're talking about the superpower that a female has, and a superpower that is jettisoned as though it has no real value in the minds of so many people.
Yeah, it's really true. Feminism has sort of replaced kind of natural, innate femininity. And I think that feminists have convinced women that their natural, innate femininity, and by femininity, I don't mean you like to wear pink and you like to wear, you know, lace and ruffles. That's not really what I'm talking about. I'm talking about femininity is just like being the woman that you were born, you know, letting your femaleness express itself naturally, which can take the form of maternity oftentimes, wanting to attract a mate, wanting to, when you're young, to look, you know, look your best, to try to attract a mate. This is not the patriarchy telling us what to do. You have to adhere to this beauty standard. This is Mother Nature designing us to attract a mate and to become monogamous when we're still young enough to reproduce. This is just part of the natural world. And that's what I mean by being feminine. And feminism has replaced that. They ripped out femininity and replaced it with feminism as like an upgrade, but it has really been a major downgrade to women. When beauty standards are out, then we have a huge rise in obesity. We have a huge rise in young women who feel like power. I'm empowered. That means I have to, you know, shave my head or dye my hair weird colors or pierce my body or cover myself in tattoos, because that's empowering to not look like in their head, a stereotypical woman. And then feminism also tells women that no, your greatest value is not in the home, is not as a female. Your greatest value to society is what you do for a living. What are you doing for the economy? What is your economic worth versus your female worth? And so that's why we have women who dive into their career, and that becomes how they get all the, you know, social media affirmation, all the likes, all the praise, how wonderful, how heroic they are. That's sort of the girl bossism that has taken hold. And what that does is makes you basically run out the clock on your femininity, i.e. on your fertility. And you have women who they give all their good years to their boss. And when they finally realize, oh, well, maybe I do want a child, you know, their eggs the frozen eggs are expired. And they have to undergo massive amounts of reproductive technology is the kind of euphemistic term for pretty barbaric and expensive modes of having children. And they end up with, you know, in their middle age, really suffering a lot. So I think it has been a blight. It has broken up families. It's made men kind of irrelevant to women's happiness and to family formation. And so, yeah, my advice is to become an anti-feminist, to just reject it totally, and become instead a domestic extremist.
I want you to expand on that a little bit. I think this is such an important subject, and I'm not sure that everybody is hip to it. The fact that a woman is born with a set amount of eggs, the fact that at a particular point in life, around 29, those eggs become less and less efficacious. Mm-hmm. Women are induced to stay in the workforce. Then they have this natural urge to have children. they find out that they can have children, and you make the quip in the book that, you know, then they go to these fertility clinics. No wonder you see fertility doctors driving around in $400,000 cars.
Yeah, that's right.
It's an industry, and it...
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's an intention here.
It's an incredibly lucrative industry. They are very quite happy to keep you on the track of relying on reproductive technology for your future family, because that is the most expensive route to go. You will pay. You will pay with your health, with your emotional well-being. You may end up heartbroken at the end. But the doctors are very, very happy. And the cryogenic clinics are quite happy to take your money. In the course of writing the book, the chapter on, you know, the fertility and the egg donation industry, you read, it's pretty horrifying. I mean, egg freezing, for example, has become kind of like a required benefit at big companies in their HR department. So they'll entice women because we'll pay for your egg freezing. So you can come to work and you're 32, you're single, don't worry about it, because they're not doing it to liberate you from your fertility. They're doing it to keep you shackled to your job. The last thing they want is a woman going off on maternity leave and not coming back, which happens quite often, especially in the higher paid, the higher pressure jobs, you know, corporate lawyers. Those women often will have a baby and they'll think, you know, I'm not going back, because they usually have a high earning husband. They're not, you know, they don't initially need the money. So I know many, many female lawyers who quit once they had their children, and that hurts the company bottom line. So they want to freeze your eggs so you can feel like this false promise that one day, you know, whenever I feel like it, when I'm 40, 41, I can unfreeze my eggs. But what you're not going to just magically unfreeze a fully formed family. You're not unfreezing toddlers. You're going to unfreeze eggs. You still need to get a sperm donor. If you don't have a partner, who is that person? Then you have to go through an IVF process. One thing women forget when they get lured into free egg freezing is, well, you can't freeze your body. You can't freeze your uterus. You're going to still have to get pregnant at 40 or 41 or 45. That is very difficult. Whether your eggs are frozen or not frozen, it becomes very difficult to get pregnant in your late 30s, early 40s. I mean, some women are blessed with natural fertility. I did have a baby naturally in my early 40s, but you can't rely on that. Often it will not happen for you. And there's obviously higher rates of, you know, Down syndrome and all the rest of it. So you're going to have to get a sperm donor, and then you're going to have to undergo IVF, which is very painful and has a very low chance of success. Something like, what is it? I have it in my book, 7% or 12% of all IVF cycles result in a live birth. So you're going to have to undergo that 3 or 4 times. It's a very painful process. They pump you full of hormones, and you have a very low chance of success. You may end up having to use a surrogate, a gestational surrogate, to carry your frozen egg and the sperm donor's child. That surrogate, the company does not pay for. That will cost you another $50K. By the time you get your child, you will be grandma mom. And so the whole process is really extraordinary that we've tricked these women. It's really trickery. Not to mention, I go into this also in the book, the kind of duplicitous, really disgusting methods of enticing young women to sell their eggs. So if you don't freeze your eggs are bad, you don't have any more eggs, you can buy eggs. A lot of infertile couples buy eggs. Gay men, single gay men, and gay men in couples will buy eggs. And it's really a weird form of eugenics, where you are really truly designing a baby. On the egg donation websites, you can scroll through a long list of very, very specific racial categories, which you do not ever find on, let's say, a college application. I think it's very interesting. There's like a million categories for different kinds of, you know, white donor women. Every European country you can name. There are very few, I looked it up, African-American egg donors. And so, I mean, is this industry racist? Is this white supremacy being perpetuated? It's very interesting, but they won't talk about that because these are mostly, you know, people on the left, liberals who are buying all of these eggs. And the women who donate their eggs are doing it to pay off college debt. So how convenient that they're all in such horrible college debt and have to resort to this. Basically, it is to me a form of prostitution. You're selling your body, but even worse is you're selling basically your future children. And then there are these awful horror stories of egg donor regret. So these are women who, when they were 22, sold their eggs for $10,000. And the procedure triggered infertility. So now they cannot have any of their own children. But they do have live children. They are the biological mother of live children who exist, who were born to someone who bought those eggs. They will never meet those children. They will never see photos of those children. Those children will never see a picture of that woman's face. And that is a real thing that happens. And it's the idea that this is all liberating. This all is to free women. The battlefield is now littered with the victims of feminism, of reproductive technology. And no one is really giving a thought to the children who are victimized by this, the young women who are victimized by this. And those sections of my book, I mean, obviously those are serious things and they're not really a laughing matter, but I think it's really great to just shine a light on it. Cause I think people just aren't allowed to really talk about that. And so I'm really proud that I was able to like write about that in the book.
Well, I'm proud of what you just did, because this is one of the most succinct elaborations on the subject I've ever heard. I think it is worth the price of admission. You talk a lot about feminism, and I've had quite a few shows on this podcast on feminism. I want you to expound on this some as well, because you have feminism not just in one form, but you have wave after wave after wave. And you actually, in your book, talk about how significantly aberrant the fourth wave of feminism really is.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I can't condemn the original first wave feminists. I understand where they were coming from. These were Victorian women who, you know, were seeing poor women who, let's say their husband died, they have to resort to becoming prostitutes to feed their children because they were not allowed to get a job. They had noble intentions. I mean, I don't fault them. And I think, you know, giving women more of a say in society, equal rights to divorce, all those things, those were not necessarily bad. You know, if a woman's being abused, she could leave her husband without prosecution. She could get a job, like she could vote. I'm not saying take those things away. We really run into trouble with the second wave feminism, the boomers, who, you know, under the sexual revolution happened and they embraced, you know, birth control, the pill, on-demand abortion, and like women's lib, which really kind of put men kind of second. And then third wave feminism was basically like had a kind of a racial component to it. And like wokeism came out of third wave feminism. Fourth wave feminism is very funny to me because it's no longer feminism. It's basically like transgender feminism, where feminists found a category of women they like better than women. And that category is men. It's men who think that they are women. And I mean, I don't even think the men think they're women. I think they kind of get off on you being forced to think that they're women. They know that they're not women, but their kink, it's sort of like a sexual fetish. Their kink is to force us, the normal people, to call them she, her, and ma'am, and treat them like women. And they get to parade around in our daughters' locker rooms, nude, and fully intact. And that is sort of their, you know, that's their kink. That's how they're getting off. So that's where fourth wave feminism has brought us. I can't even imagine what fifth wave feminism will require. I mean, infant sacrifice on volcanoes. I mean, we're headed to a very weird place. And so I'm arguing that the whole thing should just be, it's over. They jumped the shark. You asked for feminism. Well, now you're getting it good and hard. And you look around at biological women, at young women and girls, you know, you've seen rates of depression, anxiety, suicide attempts. These are girls and women who are not happy. Feminism, second and third wave feminism, promised happiness. You know, that was the promise. You will be free and freedom will make you happy. They are not happy. That's just clear. I mean, if you see a group of teenage girls, you know, chances are they're, you know, they've talked about their various mental illnesses, identity crises, gender dysphoria. They're not sure what their gender is. They don't know who they're attracted to. and they're popping, you know, mood stabilizers. These are not a happy group of people. Women who have been on Tinder, like dating apps like Tinder, for 10 years without finding the love of their life, I can guarantee you that they are not happy either. So we can see that the lie has been proven as a lie. Freedom did not make you happier. Certain aspects of the early days of feminism were fine. Here I am. I'm a writer. Like, nothing held, no one ever held me back. I don't ever feel like I was denied something because I'm a woman. I mean, there are certain things I don't want, and I don't think other women should be encouraged to want them. For example, like becoming a Navy SEAL or something. Like, there are certain things, like, you know, if you're going to be a firefighter and you're a woman, I mean, you know, that's something that I don't aspire to. I would be fine if every fireman, you know, on a ladder rescuing babies was a 300, 200 pound, you know, football linebacker. Like, that seems more natural. So I think we have to pump the brakes on feminism. We have to, I mean, in my view, rip it out by the roots, salt the earth, and level it, and start something else, and really go back to, I mean, we can't ever return to some like idyllic 1950s housewife. That wasn't perfect either. But we have to kind of figure out how to cobble together our own emotional well-being and figure out how to raise these families. I mean, here we are. Here I am, mother of five, living in California. Oh no, what do I do? Like, there's two Planned Parenthoods in my neighborhood, you know? You turn on the TV, you watch a movie, and there's a non-binary character who's, you know, is a girl, but she's been told not to identify as a girl. So how do you, you know, what do you do? So this book is really my reaction to all of that, because I really do feel like it's the only way. Becoming more domestic, recentering yourself around the natural, the true, the inborn, your home, your family, your spouse, and just kind of doubling down on that and not letting the culture tell you made a mistake. You shouldn't stay home with your kids. You shouldn't. Oh, you've been married too long. Aren't you bored? You know, don't you want to open up your marriage or whatever? Like, just kind of shutting all of that down and treating this lifestyle, this kind of normal lifestyle that I have, I think it's very normal. Treating it really now as a vocation, you know, because the alternative is so bleak. It is the path of no return. And I feel very lucky that I escaped feminism. You know, like I say in my book, Hank, you know, I feel like I escaped feminism by the skin of my teeth. I kind of just made it out, you know, Indiana Jones under the cave wall as it's closing. I kind of escaped. I don't know what young women are doing now. I think it is so much harder for them with the internet and social media and dating apps and everything else. And, you know, I tell women, my recommendation to my own children is, you know, I would love you guys to get married by your mid-20s, start your families in your 20s. I was raised to believe that you don't do that till you're 30. You spend your 20s having fun. And I was not in a marriage mindset. I wanted, you know, our goal, me and my friends, was to avoid marriage, to avoid pregnancy. That was the key. And maximize our career opportunities and to like be cool and live what we thought were quasi-glamorous lives. They were in retrospect, not very glamorous. But those were our priorities. And so I just feel very lucky that I'm not passing that down to my daughters. They are, you know, I'm not trying to live vicariously through them, getting them on birth control when they get their period and putting them in like kind of overly sexualized outfits. I'm really trying to, it's hard, you know, keep them modest, keep them chaste. And I feel like they, at this point, have internalized that. I credit a lot of it to my conversion to Catholicism. You know, that feels like a big shortcut to where my end goal, to where you want to go. And it's incredibly, it's like getting a vaccine for the culture, really, when you become a Catholic and you're trying to raise children in the faith who really believe it. It does feel like, in a way, that you have given them this like lifetime vaccine to the mind virus of wokeism or whatever. There's no guarantee in life, you know, you can't guarantee that everybody is going to turn out the way you want, obviously, you know. But I think you give yourself at least a fighting chance.
Are you maybe in summary fashion saying that what you need to do to be feminine is to lean into the superpower that only women have?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, as a Catholic, I think that, you know, Mary is obviously an example that that women can think about to turn to. Here we have a very young woman who has become this like very powerful, you know, figure, role model, you know, Jesus's mother. And she did it very quietly. She didn't have to go on like marches and rallies. You know, she didn't have to dabble in politics. It had nothing to do with politics. It had to do with this very kind of pure devotion, this sacrificial love to her faith and to her family, to her son. And so that is one good example. And now we're not all going to be called to be the mother of Jesus, but it's a really interesting role model. And, you know, being more like Mary.
It's the quintessential role model. I mean, if you think about, I mean, she's the quintessence of theosis. Right. I mean, she's everything. Right. And the role model for all of humanity is a woman.
That's right.
It is Theotokos, the mother of God.
Yeah, I mean, I think about her a lot. You know, I'm just in terms of other role models. You know, if you like a more militant role model, I think I love Joan of Arc. She's one of my favorite. And then, and you can look at the litany of saints. I mean, Saint Agatha was my baptism name. Just her ability to resist under great pressure, you know, and die as a martyr. Sometimes I think, well, you know, people ask me, why do you do this? Like, why are you on Twitter? Why do you bother with all of this? Don't you just want to, you know, relax? I'm like, yes, I do. I never dreamed that I would be on the front lines of the culture war. But part of me thinks, well, I mean, maybe I'm being called to do this. I don't know. I can't sit silently. And so I don't have, you know, I'm not advocating for violence. I don't march in the streets. All I can offer is my gift. And if I have any gifts, maybe it's the ability to put some words together that maybe have some effect. So that is what I, you know, that's sort of what I do. But just about being feminine and about being, you know, the great supernatural power of that, you know, that's one of the reasons why feminism is so nefarious. And why, when you look at who is telling young women not to get pregnant, that they can abort their baby, you know, Barack Obama saying that he didn't want one of his daughters punished with a baby. It's because they know that once you are holding your own newborn for the first time, you don't care. There's nothing that's going to take that baby away from you. There's no government force that is going to convince you to get rid of that baby. It takes incredible Your whole mission in life is to protect that child. You know, the maternal instinct is so powerful that it took decades to kind of chip away at it enough, to kind of weaken it enough that women can be like, oh yeah, I'll just have, you know, an abortion at 8 months or whatever. It took a long time to get women out of their natural maternal instinct. You know, women's maternal instinct, it's so powerful. Women can lift, you know, lift cars off children who gets trapped under them. I mean, it really is in a way a supernatural strength. Women can give birth to 10 children, to 12 children. Their bodies just kind of do this incredible thing. And it took a lot of work for them, a lot of media education over decades to convince us otherwise, to convince us that it was not a power, but that our fertility was actually a problem. It was something that we had to control. It had to be stopped. And look over there, there's a career. Look over there, there's a, you know, chai macchiato at Starbucks. Like, don't, you know, there's a cute guy. Like, there's Coachella. Don't think about your actual power. And I do feel like becoming a mother and having these children, it does give you a sense of natural power. You have, at least for a few years, total control over these little people.
Yeah, beautifully said. I want to read something from your book and have you comment. I found this very powerful, getting back to fourth wave feminism. You say, fourth wave feminism has transformed the world's finest fighting force into a feminized freak show. To honor Women's History Month, the United States Air Force posted an interview on its official social media accounts with the sole woman in all of the Air Force they chose to honor. Lieutenant Colonel Bray Fram, who is a man, one of the highest ranking openly transgender women in the military. And then you go on to point to the highest ranking transgender woman being Dr. Rachel Levine, 4-star admiral in the U.S. Public Health Service Commissioned Corps. That's an incredibly powerful paragraph in which you're talking about the elimination, as it were, of women. I mean, where men now become better women than women.
Yeah, look, men won. Men won again. Thanks to feminism. You know, men have kind of always been the secret beneficiaries of feminism. I mean, in the 60s, men benefited by finally they could have sex with women and they didn't have to marry them if they got pregnant. They could just keep going and, you know, become these kind of playboys. And wouldn't never had to worry about being chased by a dad with a shotgun. They keep on benefiting. And now they're benefiting by, I mean, Women's History Month is now a celebration of transgender women. Transgender women, we've all established, are perfect women. They are better than biological women. And the reason why they're better is these are women who are, they come self-sterilized. They can't get pregnant. They can punch you out if you argue with them. You know, if they walk into the, you don't like them in your daughter's locker room and you complain, they can like give you a concussion. They're stronger and they are now celebrated everywhere in sports, you know, sports competitions, as the perfect female. And if you disagree, if you feel like they may have been, you know, I wonder, Colonel Bree Fram, I wonder sometimes, like, did she have other, were there women, other women in the Air Force, the Space Force, who felt like, wait, what about me? Bree became a woman, you know, 6 months ago. I've been here for 20 years. Where's my recognition? You know, I've been here working, serving my country as a woman. And no, they're, well, you don't have a penis. So I'm sorry. You're not allowed to get the women's award.
Yeah, it's just absurd. What do you mean when you use the phrase gone girls?
Oh, yeah, that's just I think that's about, you know, just like the loss of our femininity. That's a pun on the best-selling novel Gone Girl,
right,
where the wife, you know, disappears mysteriously and frames the husband for murder. So Gone Girls is really about our daughters kind of losing their identity as women. And I think that I was shocked when I read statistics about how so many young teenage girls are now identifying as things like non-binary, as gender fluid, and as bisexual, largely driven by, you know, obviously it's social contagion. They're seeing it in their friends. They're seeing it at schools. Like there'll be classrooms where 30, 40, 50% of the girls in that classroom in eighth or ninth grade are all suddenly overnight non-binary, you know, and it does feel like it's obviously a trend. It's extremely contagious and people seem to have forgotten what it is like to be a preteen and a teenage girl and how unbelievably susceptible you are to trends. I mean, and peer pressure. This is like, hello, I'm from the 80s. Like there was a million 80s movies about the mean girls and the girls and trends and, you know, who's cool, who's not cool, and how desperate you were to be in like the cool kid clique, what you had to have the right outfit or whatever, be a cheerleader. I don't know. There was huge pressure to fit in and be one of the cool kids. And so now that has just kind of been reversed. And now the kind of like, you know, the freaks and geeks, the misfit kids, who are, they have higher rates of autism, they have higher rates of childhood trauma. They somehow, they watch a video on YouTube or whatever, or Snapchat, and they decide, oh, I'm non-binary now. Or I identify as a cat, or that's a new thing too. And so the other girls, it's a trend. And the other girls just jump right in the pile. Because the worst thing you can be, you know, in my day, the worst thing you could be was to be a nerd. If you were a nerd, you know, Revenge of the Nerds, like you could, if you were seen as a nerd, like you were out, you were done. But now the worst possible thing you can be is to be, you know, as they say, a cis heterosexual, in other words, just like a straight person. just like a regular biological girl who's still a girl, who's heterosexual, you know, and that, and especially if you happen to also be white, especially if you happen to also be Christian, I mean, you are just, you're done. That's it for you. You are not, unless you live in a state like, I don't know, you know, at University of Alabama or somewhere where that's just heterosexuality and kind of gender norms are still legal. But if you're in like New York City or Los Angeles or Chicago or a big city, you know, the Bay Area, being cishet is sort of not allowed anymore. So that's what I meant by gone girls, that there's such pressure on girls. I have a friend who sends her her daughter, who's 10, to a very posh, very elite Manhattan girls' school, right? Tuition is something like $75,000 a year. And every child in the school, every girl is forced to use her makeup pronouns, and they have to use their pronouns anytime they have like a name tag or on their homework assignment, they have to say their pronouns at age 8, 9, 10. There's a girl in the school who identifies as a cat, and the school allows her to walk around on all fours and meow and like walk up the stairs as a cat. Okay. And I think she told me last year in the 8th grade classroom, something like 20 of the, it's a fairly, I don't know, 70 kids in the class, something like 20 of the kids were already non-binary or trans, of 8th grade girls. This is 13-year-old girls at the most elite private school in Manhattan. And so there's no escape from the ideology, no matter how much money you have. In private schools, I like to joke that, you know, in private school, the difference between private and public is that in private schools, the drag queens are wearing, you know, Christian Louboutin high heels and not the like Payless high heels at the public school. There's really no difference. If this happens in your school, if you want to keep your if you like your daughter and you want to keep your daughter and not have her become your son, my advice is that the first sign of that, you've got to go. You've got to grab her and go.
I want to get into a little different subject here for just a moment, although I want to get back to this in a moment as well. But talk about what you observe is the most damaging lie of all, that loveless sex is actually empowering.
Yeah, I know. You'd have think people would have figured this out by now. you know, I think it started with my generation in the 90s, like the show Sex and the City. That was, you know, a huge hit show on HBO. Everyone loved it. Everyone identified with it. You know, I would watch it with my friends, my mother. We all loved it because it was funny. We didn't really think too hard about the message of that show. To us, it was just like a fun romp and these girls, single ladies in New York City. But looking back, and I've had other friends my age also tell me that how like that show basically like ruined their lives. Because in real life, real life is not a TV show. Real life, you don't have cute outfits and you don't have a cute apartment and constant string of like cute boys to date. In real life, you're lonely a lot. You're, you know, maybe desperate to get married, maybe really want a family, don't know how to get one. And it's just this endless string of like meaningless dating. You know, I say dating as a euphemism. It's a family-friendly show. It doesn't make you... It does, of course, doesn't make you happy, but we were sold the lie that part of feminism means that a woman can be just like a man and have sex like a man without falling in love every time. That you can just, you know, like a man could have a string of kind of one night stands and not, you know, his heart, it's not about his love for him. Men are built different, okay? For women, we were told we could do that too, that you can just have, you know, a million one night stands and you know, it's fine. You're just like a man. But no one told us that really Sex and the City is about gay men. It's a show written by gay men. And this is a gay male lifestyle. Okay. Like constant, you know, string of endless one night stands. That is a common gay lifestyle. It's not a lifestyle that's ever been normal for straight women. It's never been normalized in our culture for straight, successful, together career girls or women to have just meaningless sexual encounters with no after effects of any kind. And the show sold us that lie. The characters ended up miserable and alone. Carrie Bradshaw ended up, you know, divorced and miserable. It was not a happy ending for any of them. And now, you know, the influences are even more nefarious. And so I don't understand, like, don't you understand that you're not a man? You're not a man. You're not a gay man. You're a woman. And women who deny that they form emotional attachments, that's just a denial of biology. We know that's not true. If you like someone enough to go on a date with him, if you like someone enough to sleep with him, I guarantee you, in your little heart, deep down, you kind of wish he'd liked you enough to like want you as his girlfriend. And you can deny that all you want, but that's just a fact.
You know, that fact is being shrouded over in some sense because of technology. I think about Tammy Wynette singing, "Now I Have the Pill." The pill has been an ecological disaster, which seems counterintuitive with the people that are most promoting the pill. Talk about how, I mean, you pretty much said it already, but this is a lie. This is like, okay, I have the pill. Now I can be promiscuous as men are being promiscuous. And there's no difference, no distinction. I'll be happy. It's a complete ruse.
Yeah, I mean, it's really great that you said it's ecological disaster, but because, yeah, we're just only now, you know, learning about the damage to our water table, like all that estrogen pumped into, city water systems and little boys drinking the water, bathing in the water. Is it the cause of our fertility crisis? All the xenoestrogens floating around. Is this why boys are more likely to become trans? They have lower testosterone because they've been like literally swimming and bathing in estrogen since they were babies. I mean, I don't know, maybe from the womb. The pill is such an interesting thing because it is like, it's like Chekhov's gun. You know, if you give a girl the pill as like, well, just in case, you know, just in case, honey, like when your daughter gets her period, that's often when mothers will give them the pill. The girl has the pill. So it's no longer a just in case. It's, oh, well, now I can actually do whatever I want. It's not just like an emergency backup situation. It's I'm on the pill now. So nothing matters. So let's go. We're also learning more and more now about the after effects of the pill. They actually cause women, I like to joke, the real way the pill works is not that it sterilizes you, but it makes you basically lose all interest in sex. It decreases women's libido dramatically. It causes weight gain. It causes crazy hormonal fluctuations that can all make you really uninterested in dating. And then I saw a statistic, I think it was last year, they did a study that said there's much higher rates of lesbianism from formerly straight women who had been on the pill. They actually lost all interest in men just generally, thanks to the artificial hormones. Isn't that interesting? Because is that one of the causes why so many women are just choosing to, they're lesbians now, you know? And so, yeah, the birth control pill, the other thing about it is that a lot of women I know who, you know, they want another child, they're on birth control, or maybe they're on long-term birth control, like an IUD, you know, which is sort of implanted in you, and you have to actually make it a doctor's appointment and have it removed before you get pregnant again. And for the pill, you have to go off it and be off it for a while before you can get pregnant again. So it does seem like the biggest choice that women may have to make once you're on a form of birth control is, well, when do you get off it? And that can be very scary because you have to actually make an active decision to stop doing this thing that you've been doing for a long time. You have to actually call the doctor, have them do something to you. And then it's kind of scary because your safety net is gone. And that it can be very easy for someone to say, well, I'll do that later. You know, not today, next week. And lo and behold, a year goes by. And another year ticks by and you're still on it because you just can't make that active decision to stop. It's just a little bit of a barrier to your decision-making process. And it really does get in the way because you have to time it and then you're looking at your calendar. Oh, do I want to get pregnant around Christmas? Should we wait till the summer? As if you can time a pregnancy. You cannot time your pregnancy unless you're very lucky. You know, the average time it takes someone to get pregnant is a year, and that's for fertile young people. It can take a year, you know, unless you're very blessed. It can take you longer. You never know what can happen. You might get pregnant right away, and then you have a tragic miscarriage, and you have to start the process over.
You had that experience. So I try to tell people,
I did have that experience. My first pregnancy, you know, we were like, you know, babes in the woods. We had no I didn't even know any, what was going on. I thought once you were pregnant, that was it. I never even really knew about miscarriage. I thought it was something like, you know, very, very rare. I didn't know that it basically happens to almost everyone I know. And we had seen the baby's heartbeat. It was 3 months. We had, you know, basically named the baby at that point. We were, you know, fine. Everything's fine. And so to see on the screen, you see the fetus, the little, you know, the little peanut, and then suddenly you're not hearing the heartbeat. And you're like, where's the heartbeat? It was just this really shocking moment, really horrible moment in my life. My husband and I were just like, what? And you know, that triggered all these things. But it triggered my husband to convert to Catholicism. He informed me that week that he was going to become a cat, go back. He had been baptized as a baby, but he was going back because he couldn't even handle like the grief that we were experiencing. So yeah, I mean, things, you know, luckily I'm very fortunate. I got pregnant, I think 4 months later, and that baby is about to turn 18 years old, which is like incredible. So there is obviously hope after miscarriage, but it can delay you. There's all kinds of things that can happen, and the pill and the long-term birth control, it just like delays it so much. And then it requires this very heavy mental lift to figure out, well, am I really going to do this? How am I going to afford that baby? Sometimes it is better to just let nature take its course. It just seems like let nature make that decision for you. I had two children. Like sometimes we would, you know, I'm a proponent of natural family planning, which is a non-hormonal way of kind of timing things out, which I recommend to some people. You can avoid, you know, if you don't want to have like Irish twins, you know, that which is fine, but but I think twice in my life we were just like completely stunned and found me pregnant again. You know, probably before I was ready or wasn't expecting it. And those turned out to be just such incredible blessings. The surprises became like, well, you know, thank goodness. Like, I remember for my second, my doctor, after my first, I wasn't Catholic yet. My doctor had given me a prescription for birth control pills, like on the first postpartum visit. You know, all doctors just throw that to you. They just give it to you. They give you the lecture. You can't have another baby. You know, don't get pregnant again. Wait 3 years, whatever. And so I had them in my purse. I was like, I don't know, I'll think about it later. And I wasn't even conscious of really making any decisions at that point. I didn't want to go on the pill, but I wasn't necessarily like, you know, like I said, I wasn't Catholic yet. So I wasn't like I wasn't really sure, but I hadn't made that decision. And so I found out I was pregnant again when I had a 6-month-old baby at home and I was pregnant again. And yeah, no idea how that happened to this day. And sometimes I just think to myself, like I was joking to my husband, did I sit in something? Like, I don't know how that happened. but like, my gosh, what if I had decided, oh yeah, he told me to take them. I better pop those pills. You know, then I have this child now who's alive, who's a teenager. And so you kind of, you know, it's like the magic of not choosing sometimes is the best choice.
Mm. You mentioned just briefly in passing the IUD, and you do deal with this in your book, but I don't think people are sufficiently aware of the horror of that device.
Yeah. Like I said, doctors, I have yet to meet a doctor who's ever felt the way I do about these things. They're all on board with all of it. And so I had my last baby with the last one. Yeah. And, you know, my fifth baby, and I was in my 40s. And so my doctor told me I was Catholic at this time. And she said, well, you should get on the IUD. I can put one in for you. And I was like, you know, don't think so. But I had never really heard of it. And I was like, what even is that? I had no intention of doing it. I didn't do it, obviously. But I researched it at that point to find out what is this? And my liberal friends were telling me about their experience and how unbelievably painful it was to have it put in you. It's like a permanent device that lives in your uterus or something. One of my mother's best friends for many, many decades was rendered permanently infertile by the very first IUD, the Dalcon Shield, which ended up killing, I think, hundreds of women and rendered infertile you know, several million women, I believe. And the Dalkon Shield, there was giant lawsuits and it was incredible malpractice. And so I grew up knowing that this woman, you know, she adopted two children because of her IUD experience. So I've always been wary of it. And then in the course of researching the book, I found out about one of the forms is not just one that just physically prevents egg, implantation. It releases hormones. So it's like having a long-term hormone releasing device at all times in your body. And just reading women's reports of the side effects was scary. And I include those just direct quotes from some message board I found, which is like, honestly, there was hundreds of messages of women saying, I gained 50 pounds. I'm suicidal. The doctors think I'm crazy. They won't take it out. They want to put me on antidepressants, but I know it's not that. It's because of the hormonal IUD, and like no one will help me. And the nurses will whisper, this is pre-COVID, you know, the nurses will whisper, you're not alone. Like lots of girls, it's the IUD, but we're not allowed to say that. They're not allowed to say anything bad about these miracles that are liberating women from their own fertility. You're not allowed to talk about what the birth control pill long-term does to women. It causes breast cancer. You know, wow. Have you noticed there's a spike in breast cancer in the last, 40 years? Oh, birth control pill causes breast cancer. How interesting. You're not allowed to talk about these side effects to these, things that are given out like candy to whoever, to little kids, to young girls. But there are side effects. And I think it's important to really take charge of your body as a woman. That's part of the supernatural power of being a woman. It's very powerful. You need to take care of it because there's a lot of people, they wear white coats and they have doctor's badges and nurse's badges and they're women's activists, they're women's health experts, but they are often, have other agendas and they may not be trying to hurt you physically, but they really, really, really don't want you having too many kids. And that's just the bottom line in my experience.
Yeah. I want to go to the other side of the equation. I mean, it's not necessarily the other side of the equation, but you talk about men and how they are being enslaved by smut. It's not just men, again, but a predominant number of men in our culture are literally enslaved to pornography today. And it starts at a very early age, and what you have in your hand with the smartphone is oftentimes the gateway.
Yeah, absolutely. My son was first exposed to pornography on another little boy's cell phone at a Catholic carnival, like a fair. They were in line for a ride. He must have been, 8 years old, 7 or 8 years old. And another boy who did not go to that school had his phone and showed them a picture of a close-up of a penetrative act. And it was horrifying to these two little boys. This is at a Catholic school. It was horrifying to them. And then it required us to have to talk about what it was. And they didn't know it. They didn't know the birds and the bees at that point. So we had to kind of have a whole emergency session, like, oh my gosh. So it's very hard to escape. It's so pervasive and it is so addictive. You know, there's been some of the things I cite in the book. Pascal Gobry did a great piece about proving scientifically that pornography addiction is basically the same as meth addiction. It's the same pathways in the brain. It's the same after effects in your brain, the same withdrawal, the same habituation. You need to kind of keep ratcheting it up, getting a bigger dose of more extreme imagery or whatever. And it's very hard to quit. And it is like taking a drug, and you become kind of unable to form healthy, normal relationships with human beings. And it is so destructive. And not to mention, it is a grave sin. You know, we you and I are aware of, just the destructive lifestyles behind the camera of the exploited men and women on the camera. Like, just it's human trafficking and drug use and all the rest of it. I think a lot of these porn sites have children are being victimized with no recourse of any kind. So when you watch it, you're taking part in that world and you're contributing to it and you're giving them money and attention. And it's bad in every way. Yeah. So young men, because the dating world, but here's the thing, because women have become feminism, thanks to feminism, women don't need men anymore. They're not interested in you as a provider. They're not interested in you. They're all bisexual, lesbians, or non-binary, so they don't need you for anything. Men also have a crisis of loneliness, a crisis of identity. And I mean, I understand why men are drawn to pornography websites or to places like OnlyFans, where you can kind of have a kind of like a fake digital girlfriend who will know your name and she'll talk to you and you just keep sending money and she'll be your friend, you know, the girlfriend experience. It's very depressing. It's really sad. And I mean, what can I say as a parent? You know, you just have to kind of at a very early age be like, this, like, you will go to hell. Like, yeah, you look at that stuff, you're going to hell. Like, it's really, really bad. The devil, that's the devil trying to tempt you. So we're trying to do that with our kids. Again, there's no guarantee in life. I mean, I think that sometimes they can, you know, they can, you can stumble across something, you can, someone can send you a meme with something and you have to like, you're, so they're aware of it, you know, and they've been taught about it in school. They educate them on the dangers of pornography. And so I think they are scared of it the way they are with drugs. I mean, we really, in our house, we treat it the same as a drug. You know, it's like, you're not going to smoke meth, right? So don't look at this. It's just meth for your eyes.
Yep. You say the demise of marriage was the plan of the feminist supervillains, and you actually give four steps. I'm going to read them briefly and maybe have you comment here, but step one is rebrand marriage as something bad men do to oppress women. Step number two is remove the stigma of unwed motherhood. Step number three is always be swiping at dating hookup apps. And number four, invent expensive and invasive reproductive technology that renders marriage and men unnecessary. That's a litany of steps that's pretty toxic.
Yeah. And I mean, it really does seem like someone designed this. Like, I mean, maybe it was just accidental. Maybe it was just, you know, kind of the natural course of modernity. But it really does feel like, that meeting, that Kate Millett 1960s era, early 70s era feminist awakening meeting that I cite in the book, where her and the other second wave boomers sat around and they're like, what do we want? We want a world where, you know, we want to destroy the nuclear family. We want, you know, women above men. We want to, you know, destroy masculinity. They stated this out loud. They don't like to talk about it too much now, but they used to be very open with the scheme, which was to liberate women from the oppressive bonds of marriage. Marriage is a prison. It's a jail. You know, your husband just needs someone to like wash his socks and cook his food and have his children and shut up. And like, I mean, I don't know, like maybe that was true for women in like, you know, Elizabethan England or medieval Europe. I don't know. I mean, that's not my experience at all. Are there bad marriages out there where women are oppressed and women are abused or beaten? Like, yes, that is true. There are cultures where men can beat their wives with impunity and they can just divorce them by saying, I divorced you three times, in sort of these kind of like older school Middle Eastern cultures. Yes, that's all true. But modern marriage, in my experience, is not that. I mean, most of the trad moms I know, the trad caths, if you ask them, like they're pretty much in charge. You know, I mean, the wife is making most of the decisions for the household anyway. And so my friends who are, you know, like me, living these sort of extremely domestic lives, they, wives and husbands, have a very beautiful, harmonious relationship. There is recognition. There used to be recognition. There still is in my community of men and women are very different and very complementary to each other. You know, they're friends. You're in a partnership. My husband and I are, you know, we're in the foxhole together under heavy shelling. When you have three children under three, you're like, oh, we just have to survive together. You're kind of in the lifeboat of life with your partner, and you both have to row. And someone's going to do this task, and someone's going to do this task, and it's all going to get done, and that's fine. And so, I mean, I don't know. I think we kind of solved the war between the sexes and what marriage is. I don't really even think about it, like, to be honest, in my day-to-day life. And I certainly do not feel oppressed by my marriage. I often feel very grateful, like so grateful, you know, that I'm not just some like random single woman of a certain age. It's like, that just seems like, how sad. I would be so lonely and probably be weird at this point. So I think that it is beautiful when done by two people who know what they're, who, like I say in the book, you have to have the talk beforehand and just decide beforehand. You know, a lot of people I know when we were all getting married at a certain age were like, they would say to me, well, if things don't work out, or if I find someone better, or if I'm out, I'll just get divorced. No big deal. Like, it's nothing. Like, it's returning a defective pair of, you know, shoes to the shoe store. You know, no, it's a little more complicated than that. And, you know, I'm a child of divorce, of a boomer divorce. And I just knew, even before I even met my husband, even back when I was a liberal feminist, I knew that if I ever got married, I would never, ever want to get divorced.
Your husband, interesting, you talk about him in the book, but he is responsible, I guess, for the first really insightful argument that you heard on abortion.
That's
because
right.
You believed in abortion.
True.
But he pressed the issue in such a way that you had to think about the ramifications of your belief system and then gave it up.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was lucky to meet him. At that moment, I'd already basically become like a political conservative, kind of in that wake of 9/11. The liberals went all the way to the left. And I kind of was like, wait, but what? I feel like I'm a patriotic person. So where do I fit? But it wasn't until I met him, and he happened to be a former liberal also. And he had his own pro-choice beliefs challenged by a friend in grad school, a person who I think was like a Orthodox Jew, had kind of talked him out of being pro-choice, because we were all by default Gen X. Unless you were raised in a religious household, you were pro-choice. There was no other message. You know, everyone was pro-choice. Abortion was fine. It was a clump of cells. That's it. Like, there was no argument. No one had ever debated me on this in my life. My friends had gotten abortions, and I thought, well, I don't want to have one, but I mean, it's good they did. Like, that was my attitude to it. But he had had this kind of revelation. He had had this like transformation, this, you know, conversion. And so that was one of the first things we ever debated very early in our relationship. And I remember being totally horrified. Oh no, how can I like someone who doesn't believe in abortion rights? Like, what? Don't you think women should be forced to have, you know? And he basically just methodically, he's a good arguer.
He better be married to you.
Yeah. He turned me into the domestic extremist I am today. Okay? He methodically dismantled like all my half-baked arguments. And the thing is that our arguments are half-baked. Like, it's not a clump of cells. Okay. That's a lie. There's a million lies around abortion. And I had not ever been exposed to anyone saying anything differently. And he used the story of, you know, that it was like a legal case or something where a pregnant woman was shot. And she died and the unborn baby died. So is that a double murder or a single murder? And I was left kind of grappling with the fact that, like, I finally admitted this to myself. I think I had known this, that, okay, yes, abortion is killing. Yeah, you're murdering a life. It's not like a toddler. You're not killing a toddler, but yeah, you're killing something. You're stopping someone's heart. Yeah, you are. That is what it is. But it's still up to the woman to decide if that she wants to do that or not, you know, and you're left thinking about that for a while. You're like, that doesn't sound too great. I can't make that argument. Like, oh, okay. So I lost the argument. And then I realized, really, it took, you know, to sit with that after, you know, a long time being pro-choice and not understanding even what abortion was, to really understand it, what it is, what it means, and to finally get it is a little bit traumatic. I mean, it's like, oh, it's like being deprogrammed, you know, from a cult. And yes, that was, like you said, it was the slippery slope to the rest of my my ascension into full domestic extremist extremism.
You mentioned earlier on in the conversation maternal instinct. And that's one of the most, I guess it's humorous on the one hand, it's very serious on the other. But you comment on the New York Times article, maternal instinct is a myth that men created. And then you also talk about another New York Times magazine article titled The Abortion I Didn't Have. And there you have the writer actually confessing a deep lifelong regret over not aborting her son, who I presume is alive and is now grown. I mean, this, so you're denying maternal instinct, and then you have an article in the same magazine in which someone is saying, I regret not aborting my child. It's almost dystopian. Maybe it is dystopian.
Yeah, I mean, you can see the brainwashing, and you can just see it, how deep it is. And also, like, the necessity they have to keep stating it over and over again, to keep, you know, they keep shouting their abortion. Or what was the purpose of writing an article where you declare that you regret not aborting your fully grown son who can read the article? Like, how is that going to affect your relationship, lady, with your son? Mom, you wish you had aborted me? Like, it makes no logical sense at all. But you can see how the brainwashing works and how it's so invasive. But it takes really a lifetime of programming to get a woman to that stage. You know, that's why they want women in college. That's why they want you in grad school. You have to kind of go through the entire finishing school to get to the point where you're like completely fine saying those things out loud, which is a little talking. Yeah, it is totally dystopian. And that is where we are. And I like to joke, like, wait, but they call me an extremist?
Yeah. I want you to talk about something that is really controversial. Not that we haven't talked about anything that's controversial in terms of the culture already, but our headquarters is in an area where we have a couple of daycare centers. You talk about what you call the child care industrial complex, and you have a very strong view of mothers and fathers, when they have children, they ought to be committed to raising those children and not offload that responsibility to someone else. And when you do offload it, you are really missing out yourself.
Yeah. Talking about daycare as an unalloyed bad in our society, it does feel like that is where I get like the biggest pushback. It's weird. People are not comfortable with me suggesting that you should not use daycare. As Nancy Pelosi calls it, it's, you know, quality of affordable childcare. You're not allowed to suggest that dropping off your 6 week old or your 10 month old at a daycare 40 hours a week is anything wrong with that. It's just as good as being with you. In fact, that child is going to be happier because you are happier being at work than being with your child. So you're going to be in a better mood. And so the child will be in a better mood. But if you read any news story about daycare, they have fight clubs in daycares. The caregivers are usually underpaid, minimum wage people. I don't know who they're letting in. There's been child abusers. There's been people making pedophilic pornography using daycare children. There's so many stories of things you don't really want to know about happening in a daycare. And just last week, 4 children were poisoned by fentanyl in a daycare in New York City, in the Bronx. One little one-year-old boy died of a fentanyl overdose at daycare. Turns out that the woman running the daycare was also running a fentanyl chop shop inside the daycare, which is, you know, you might not know that. Like the parents said they toured it, it looked fine. Everyone said it was nice. You just never will know. But beyond your child's physical safety, yes, it is the time with that little kid that is going to grow that bond. So when you don't have that from the very earliest years, that those very, very, the first 2 years of a child's life, 2 to 3 years, are when the child's brain is growing, and what triggers the most brain growth, synapse growth, those neurons being built that will enable that child to thrive physically, cognitively, to develop properly, is all triggered literally by being in close physical proximity to its mother. That's just biology, right? The baby's cries are designed to alert the mother in a way that they don't alert strangers. A stranger, a daycare worker, can hear a baby crying, and to them, it's just another baby crying. But the mother, you know, you'll know, oh, it's hurt, it's hungry, something's wrong, its finger got stuck, something, you know. You'll know what is wrong with your baby. And so denying the mother the opportunity to bond with that child, that toddler, and you're denying the child the most important years of its life that will make it become a kind of more, better chance of becoming healthy and stable. You're breaking that up. You're shattering that. I'm not saying you have to be with your baby 24 hours a day, 7 days a week with no end in sight. Like, I understand there's times where you have to get some work done. You have to go to the store. You know, there's other options than 40, 50 hours, sometimes 60 hours a week of a newborn in a daycare. We have to do better as a society, allowing women to raise their own damn children. And for me, I left my job to be with my baby. I took a huge financial hit. It threw a wrench into our plans, but like for me, it wasn't a choice. Like there was not even a question. Like I'm not going to even, because people would suggest to me, well, they have a daycare at work. I'm like, no, like I wouldn't, you know, let these daycare workers walk my dog. I mean, you just can't do it. And I'm not saying women can't work. I'm just saying there's a season in your life to do all of the things you want to do. And if you're going to have that child, I feel like you owe it to them to devote yourself as much as you can when they're young, when they really need it. And because the cost of not doing that, you know, you'll pay later. People think, well, I can't afford it. I can't afford to stay home with my child. What you can't afford is the level of mental health issues, emotional issues, and behavioral issues that you may be facing with a child who just didn't have enough time, literally, in his mother's arms.
I got to ask you a personal question at this juncture. How in the world do you deal with the kind of pushback that you must certainly be getting? I mean, you're really knocking down some sacred cows.
Well, lucky for me, I'm not like on, you know, CNN or NBC, MSNBC talking about this stuff. I think that the pushback I get is mostly online. So like, for example, on Twitter, if people want to debate me, that's fine. But I'll block people who call me names or are very extremely rude or use profanity. I just simply block them. And then I noticed when my book came out, I got some, you know, there's plenty of bad reviews of the book, mostly on Goodreads. And they're not real reviews. These are people who didn't read the book. And the reason I know they didn't read the book is because they left their reviews before the book came out. So I know they haven't read it for the most part. I know they wouldn't buy it. They wouldn't want to give me money. And they'll be like 1-star reviews, like, you know, she wants to keep women locked up and she hates women and, you know, these over-the-top hyperbolic reviews by feminists and male feminist allies. So I think they're kind of funny. You know, I enjoy it. I'm not bothered by it at all. I want, like, you know, look, I wrote the book a little bit to trigger people. And I feel really lucky that actually, for the most part, the vast majority of all the feedback I've gotten in public, people coming up to me, people that never knew I wrote under the pseudonym, but who had been following me and then found out it was me, has been so positive, like so positive. Like, thank you for saying this. Finally, you know, someone is saying this. You're just like me. And I think one of the reasons I do this is to give other people the chance to feel like they're not alone in it. Because a lot of times, look, I'm alone in my neighborhood on my street. Like there's no one no one near who lives near me. I have so few friends, but I feel alone a lot. And, but there's so many of us out there who agree, who believe in what our calling is as women and moms. And we understand that we've been told all these lies and that they are lies, and it's okay to push back, and we should teach our daughters and our sons to push back, and we can't give in. And the peer pressure to give in and cave and like talk our husbands down or to cheat on them or whatever, all that's peer pressure that you read about. We just, we have to kind of have, you know, solidarity with each other to give each other strength, basically.
And you're talking about some things here that are extremely important. When you talk about daycare centers, you all stick to the next step and you talk about the NAE being one of the most corrupt organizations in America. The indoctrination that is taking place in schools today, starting at a very elementary level and going up through the university system, it is really mind-blowing. I talked to Yonmi Park about this in a podcast just a few weeks ago, and she was talking about her experience at Columbia University, for example, older than the country itself is. You tackled this head on. This is a systemic problem that parents have to be aware of, because we're spending billions and billions of dollars collectively on an educational system that is really broke.
I mean, yeah, I mean, the NEA and the other teachers' unions and the Department of Education, I mean, you could argue that they are actually succeeding wildly and their money is going to great use. And what they have done over the last, you know, 40, 50 years is by design. And they have churned out now several generations of perfectly formed far left activists. Young women who end up in college and they will shout you down. If you're a professor who professes anything outside the liberal narrative, they will have you fired. They will have you canceled. They will falsely accuse your son of rape just because he is a, you know, heterosexual white male or whatever. Their initiatives have worked beautifully. They're confusing enough young children to keep the transgender industry cranking. I think that Abbott Industries is a pharmaceutical company based in Chicago, and their sales of Lupron are skyrocketing. That is the hormone blocker, the puberty blocker drug. That's the first kind of line that they, the first drug they put you on. There's a huge profit to be made from getting all these people indoctrinated. So the education industry is really, it's reaping the benefits. They plowed all that money in and they got all their teachers trained in it very early on. And now they're reaping graduate after graduate. Whole colleges now are just 80, 90% or more of more, even higher, even at our most elite colleges, are producing young people who believe very strongly that the gravest threat to humanity are Republicans and climate change, you know? And they believe this with all of their hearts, and they have no interest in families. They think I'm, you know, if they met me, they would think I was just this evil, terrible, awful person who hates everyone, or so, I don't know. They make this stuff up. So, yeah. So parents have a choice. In terms of education, you have really no great options. You have public or private schools, which will indoctrinate your children and basically train them to hate you. If you're lucky, that's all you'll get, is that they'll hate you. More likely they'll become addicted to something, pornography or drugs, and they will decide to either be promiscuous or change their gender or whatever. And then you have, and then your other choice is a parochial school, which seems to be, where a lot of people are escaping to Catholic or Christian schools. If you could find one near you that's not woke yet, a lot of them are still woke though. I mean, there's a lot of wokeism in evangelical faith, so you have to kind of be careful. There's been a huge growth in homeschooling. And so if you can find a way to homeschool your children, kudos, you're going to be way, way ahead of the game. But the key is that you can no longer counter program what they're teaching your children. People used to think, well, I can send them to public school when they have the drag queens come in and they tell them that there's 25,000 genders. But at home, I tell them that the teacher's wrong. You can really no longer do that effectively because they've infused every subject with this stuff. history is now transgender history. You know, social studies is now, you know, indigenous, disabled, you know, transgender studies. Everything is infused. And if they find out that your child is not going along with it, you're going to get in trouble. So look, like I said before, your only line of defense is to flee, to get your kid out of there.
You also mentioned the healthcare industry, and you're asking the question, very poignant question, and that is, what has happened to the medical profession when you have doctors who now think it's perfectly healthy to inject an 8-year-old with experimental puberty blockers? You have doctors who think children as young as 3 are psychologically capable of understanding concepts like gender and deciding if they're born in the wrong body. If you're looking for a prescription for happiness, you say it's probably not going to come from a doctor's pen. I mean, is this overstating the case, or is this an epidemic within the medical profession?
Yeah, I mean, they have been completely taken over. You're going to be hard pressed to find any pediatrician in any city in the country who will who will buck the regulations, that are basically, doctors are being forced legally. The rules are that doctors now must ask children starting when they're 12 or 13 about their gender. They are being forced to tell them about how to use birth control, drugs, condoms, birth control pill. Do you need, you know, are you having any gender dysphoria? Doctors, this is nationwide. It's like the AMA guidelines or the pediatric, whatever. They're required in some states, I know in California, to put children through this gauntlet of question and interview. I discovered this when my son, I was kicked out of the room and his checkup, and he's like, I don't know, 15 or 16. And I was like, well, I trust him. I'm going to let this go. And I'm going to, because I wanted to know what she was going to talk to him about. So I left the room and I got him, and she said, Mom, she asked me if I was comfortable with my gender. This is a kid who's like in a basketball uniform, like a boy. He's like a boy. Am I comfortable with my gender? She told me to have safe sex. Again, this is a boy that I'm raising as a devout Catholic. He doesn't believe in fornicating out of marriage. Like, she was telling him all these things that go against everything that we're teaching him, because she has to. And I was like, okay, well, next time, great. Thank you for telling me. And I'm not ever going to leave the room again. I'm just, when they ask you to, and they will ask you, you say no. She tried to talk to me about this with another kid in the room, and I didn't leave. And I was like, listen, no, like, we're devout Catholics. He's a boy. Like, you don't need to, why are you doing this? Like, you know, he's okay with his gender. If you have eyes, like a doctor knows looking at someone, if they're sick, you can tell they're sneezing, they're coughing, right? Do those senses not work anymore? Can you tell that this little boy is perfectly happy given being a boy? He's not depressed. He's not, you know, acting weird. Like, you can, he's not wearing pigtails and makeup. Like, you know, he's happy being a boy. Why are you denying what your eyes are telling you? And she said to me, she confided in me this time. She said, yes, I agree. It's gone too far. All the other doctors at this practice agree that it's gone too far. We hate it, but we are legally compelled to ask these questions to our patients. And I was like, oh, well, yeah, thank you for telling me that. That really stinks. But basically, none of them feel empowered to fight back, to stand up and say no. Because what would happen? Would they lose their practice? They lose their livelihood? They lose their medical license? And I mean, these are people who did go into medicine, I think, to help children, to be good people. They're not evil. At least my doctors are not evil, but they are suppressing their own natural instinct, which is to not force this issue down parents' throat, to not ask a child this. And so, you know, everyone is in the grips of the same kind of rabid madness, including the doctors, who are, for the most part, not the fanatics, who are just like struggling to figure it all out. And they're probably, most of them are liberals. So they don't really want to be aligned to people maybe on the right or whatever. There are fanatics, of course, out there. You see them talking about how wonderful it is to remove the breasts of a 14-year-old girl and how bottom surgery is so wonderful. Those are really the fanatics. That's the, feels like the minority. So yeah, I mean, you can't send your kid to school. You can't get them near a public school teacher, and you can't take them to the doctor. Like, and I like to joke in the book, like, you can't, like, you can homeschool your kid, but you can't like perform surgery on your own kid, right? What are you going to do?
What about dating apps? That's something else that really caught my attention. You know, this is really, I mean, you're touching on so many seminal issues, and this is certainly one of them. And I love the way you have hit that particular issue head on.
You know, I feel very fortunate that I am a little too old to know too much about using dating apps. I don't think they were around. I think there was dating websites, but we didn't have, we had cell phones, but the app scene had not really started yet. And what I'm hearing, and you know, you can read about this everywhere you go and you meet people who are using the apps. They're not good. People are not having very good outcomes. I do know someone who is very happily married. She met her husband on the Bumble dating app. I think he was like the first guy that she met when she went on the app. They both happened to be devout Catholics. It all worked out for them. But on the other hand, for example, I have several male divorced friends and family who I'm close to. And you know, the divorces that they went through, all three of them were with a woman deciding. These are good guys. They didn't cheat on the wives. The wives just basically decided to split. They were like, I want someone different. I want someone better, whatever reason. Okay. So the men that I know, they immediately got on the apps and lost no time. I don't approve necessarily of what they chose to do, but I just reported on it because I thought it was really unbelievable. The volume and frequency with which men, single men, are using apps as sort of like a free prostitute service. It's a free escort service. Sometimes lining up 1, 2, 3, 4 dates in a weekend. The women are now basically almost kind of aware of the game, and they're just in it to get a nice dinner or like a present, or I don't, it's not really, it does feel very much like an escort situation, but it's not. And to these girls who are on the apps, they're all kind of jockeying around for like the best male to get at the end, but I don't think they're marriage minded. I think they're looking for perks, whatever that is, whatever the perk is. I have no idea. A vacation, like, I don't even know. And the whole thing is so bleak and ugly to me and like disturbing on both sides. The men and the women, what those arrangements are. It's not, I would never recommend that someone who actually wants like an actual partner in life, who wants to fall in love, this seems to be the antithesis to love. There's not a lot of love out there. I'm all for going back to in real life meetings. We have to kind of bring that back. You know, if you can find your loved one in college or at work or through friends. I met my husband really through friends. That seems to be the most effective way to ensure long-term relationship health. If you meet someone through friends, they're already coming like pre-vetted a little bit. You know someone who knows them. They have a couple recommendations. You know they're not a psychopath or whatever. But the sad thing is that a lot of young people in their 20s don't have a lot of friends. People are so online. They're so digitally hooked. They don't have big friend groups. So we're kind of painted ourselves into this very difficult corner.
You suggest 5 ways to reclaiming parental authority. I think each one of them is powerful. We've discussed so much of this already, but you say exit government schools, delete TikTok from phones. Why TikTok is a question I have for you. And I pretty much know the answer. Keep your boys male and your girls female. Hold fast to the truth. And there you may, this is, and your humor in the book is just extraordinary, but I mean, tongue in cheek, you say, if you look at the 870,000 animal species on Earth, there are a grand total of 2 genders. Same thing with human beings, duh. And the 5th, you say, become the domestic extremist your family needs. Be the parent that your children need. Those 5 things, I think, kind of summarizes a battle plan.
Yeah, no, exactly. These are not things that are, you know, complicated. I didn't go out and reinvent the wheel. These are simple, timeless you know, eternal truths, but they seem to be very difficult to say out loud, difficult to put in practice. So I say like they're simple, but they're not easy, right? Yeah, I mean, just like the truths thing, like I just from day one of the whole, you know, gender, hearing about the gender stuff, I would just say to my kids flat out, like, well, there's you can be a boy or a girl, you know, at the zoo. How many genders do you see at the zoo? You know, there's a male elephant and there's a girl elephant and there, that's it. Like, there's no new stuff like under the sun. And so just raising them with these like eternal truths, sorry, you know, that's just it. Like, your eyes are brown, they're going to stay brown. There's no way around. Just like the facts of biology. Sorry about that, kids.
My son has a question for you. What is the best way to convince someone, let's say a liberal young feminist, to become a domestic extremist? I guess that's a good way to wrapping up the podcast.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, the very liberal young women are not necessarily flocking to bookstores to buy my book. We'd get a little bit angry at this message. How dare I suggest that they give up something? So what I've been saying is that really the best way to get them is if there's enough capable, brave young men who can kind of woo them out of it. You know, it worked for me. Okay. We need some toxic males to go around and literally kind of force women to let go of these ideas. I think that's one way to do it. The other thing that's maybe going to give your son some hope is that there is a huge pushback starting, okay, among young women, among Zoomers and millennial women, who are realizing, and they're on TikTok, which you shouldn't have, but these women are on TikTok, and they're posting videos about how disappointed they are and disillusioned they are with feminism and with dating apps and with hookup culture, and how they don't feel empowered by it. They feel disgusted by it. They feel belittled by it. They feel humiliated by it. They want something different. And they are kind of now rediscovering old-fashioned trad values, but they're kind of, to them, it's new. Like, I discovered this really cool thing. It's called monogamy, or like, I discovered this really new idea. It's called true love, you know? And so that's fine. They want to rebrand it. This is like this cool, edgy, new lifestyle. Like, yeah, it's radical, man. you know, forsaking all others till death do you part. Whoa. It's edgy, and it really is. And so what I'm trying to do is start a counterculture. It is a very fringe, radical kind of punk rock thing to do, become a domestic extremist.
But I mean, you're actually talking about how, in the scope, in the big picture, you have a man that you love, that loves you. You're beautiful now, but maybe when you're 80, you won't be quite so beautiful.
Well,
but he's still going to see you through the same eyes he saw when he married you. You're going to have someone that holds your hand if,
right,
you know, if he outlives you or vice versa on your deathbed. I went through a very long struggle with stage 4 mantle cell lymphoma, and my family was there. My kids were there. My wife was there. My grandkids were there. Mm-hmm. That support network is probably the reason I'm sitting here right now. So, yeah, I mean, you talk about these are really tangible benefits to fidelity, to monogamy, yeah, to jettisoning all that the culture is throwing at you and going back to that which ought to be normative.
Yeah, well, I'm so glad that you are better. That's crazy. Wow. And that your family was there for you. Exactly. I think people forget that we are mortal and that we die, and we all die much quicker than we would like. And life goes much faster than you think it's going to go when you're 25. At my age, I'm now like, oh no, like, here we go. Kind of cresting that hill a little bit. And I didn't really think about death until I was a Catholic, because when you're a liberal, there's no death. You know, you don't think about death. That's because I was an atheist. So when you die, that's it. So I'm not going to think about that ever again. I'm just going to always be young. And that's just, I'm always going to be this age. And thinking about death made me realize, like, okay, let me reverse engineer my own death. Where do I want to be when I'm dead? Where do I want to be the last few years of my life? What do I want that to look like? For a lot of people, they're making choices now, not thinking about 30, 40 years in the future, what that's going to be like for them. And a lot of them, unfortunately, it's very sad. I hate thinking about it, are going to be totally alone. And, you know, people are going to find their bodies, you know, devoured by their cats, or, you know, they're not, there's no one even going to do checkup. Who are they? It's not going to look like Sex and the City. You know, you're going to be old and alone. And it's very depressing. If you go to a nursing home, I used to go and volunteer at nursing homes, and you see old women, old men, a lot of more old women than men. And they, you know, they say, no one comes to visit me. I don't have kids, or I have one kid and they don't come visit. And it's very, very, very depressing. And, you know, that's a fate I don't wish on anybody, even my worst enemies. And I certainly don't want that for myself. I hope that at least one of my children still loves me enough at the end. But yeah, I mean, the idea that you have this companion, you're only going to be like young and hot for a very short time. You know, you think it's forever. No, no. That's a very short window that you have to like look cute for each other. And then eventually, you know, you're only going to look cute, if you're lucky, to that one person still. They're going to be the only one who still sees you. Yes. They recognize that you're now, you're, you know, 70 or whatever, but they can still see you as you were because they knew you then. And that is so priceless. You can't, no one else has those memories. No one in the world, not even your children, have those memories. Your parents are dead. So your spouse is this kind of like living record of you as you were, hopefully when you were, you know, at your cutest or at your most youthful. And they're the only person in the world who has that, can look at you still maybe with that filter. And that to me feels like, you know, what it's all about. I don't know. Like, I don't want to be alone. And I pray to God every day that my husband and I, we die the same minute, you know, and then we're buried in the same coffin. That's like, that would be good. And I hope that's in many, many years. But I think that, you know, to not have ever had that is so heartbreaking. You know, my mother is divorced. She never remarried. And I think she is lonely. She has us, she has her grandchildren. We'll make sure, you know, that she's never alone. But I definitely feel right now, I feel very blessed. Like whatever arguments and disagreements my husband and I have, which we have, we're normal people, you know, sometimes they drive you crazy sometimes. But like at the end of the day, I'm just very, so grateful and so blessed that I have someone who still loves me, even though I wrote this book, who I love. And so if you can say that in life, I mean, I think you're just way ahead.
Well, I think this is a brilliant book. Truly, when my son came to me with this book, he said, Dad, you got to read this book. He said, I read this book, and I mean, a lot of times I was all by myself laughing hysterically. And wow. It's in the context of making a cutting edge point. And so you are brilliant at writing, at the use of humor, and for the audience, this book, Domestic Extremist, A Practical Guide to Winning the Culture War, Peachy Keenan, available to anyone who stands shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. You can get your copy on the web at equip.org. You can also write me at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. You absolutely nail our mission statement. You're interesting, informative, inspirational, and I thank you so much. I mean, you're going to help so many people through your wit and your wisdom.
Oh, that is so kind of you to say. I'm so humbled by that. Thank you so much. I mean, I certainly hope so. That was the reason I wrote it. So let's see. Thank you.
It's from the heart. Thanks so much. Peachy Keenan, again, Domestic Extremist, The Practical Guide to Winning the Culture War. If you enjoy the podcast, please subscribe, rate, review. It helps a lot. Thanks for tuning in to this edition of Hank Unplugged. Look forward to seeing you next time with more of the podcast.